Les séminaires du Collège de France.
Merci beaucoup pour l'invitation. Je vais passer en anglais. So I'm going to switch to English. So I'm going to tell you work which was done primarily in the Max Planck Institute of Molecular Cell Biology and Genetics in Dresden. But as Jean-François was saying, I moved to Milan. And this is just a couple of words about this new institute because I think it's quite exciting. At least for me, it's very exciting. So it's called the Human Technopole. And it has actually something where the Italian government has done something good for science, which doesn't happen very often. So it has devoted basically what was the park that was hosting the exhibition, the international exhibition, the Expo 2015, into a technology park. And they have given support really to an institute to make research in the biosciences. And this is the mission, is to unravel pathophysiological molecular mechanisms using a multi-scale systems biology approach. So we focus on number of disease, and we have a number of competence areas. So these are medical and population genomics. So you have patient material that you analyze. You have functional genomics. You see how the genome is expressed and works. Neurogenomics, the nervous system. Molecular cell biology, which is an area which we are promoting now. Structural biology, very, very strong. Cryo-electron microscopy, the really best level. And computational biology and biophysical modeling and simulation, which I think really, as Jean-François was saying, really, it absolutely, I think I'm preaching to the converted. It's absolutely necessary to understand biology. And health data science, which is basically harvesting information from patients. And therefore, it has a biomedical interest in this. But what is good about this as well is that the institute provides research infrastructure, access to research infrastructure of the highest level to Italy. And you know, in Italy, there is not really so much money given in research. In France, you have a strong tradition. And in Italy, I think people have not always had access to funds, which are structured in order to get research done. But in this case, the part of the budget of the institute is devoted to opening these facilities, the highest level facilities, for Italian scientists. And the projects are sponsored by the institute budget. So it's actually quite a good system because you centralize research infrastructure in the area of structural biology, genomics, light imaging, genome engineering, and disease modeling. You create model systems from human disease, from patients, reprogramming cells. And then data handling and analysis. You see, these are a lot of, in reality, these are five areas, but there is a lot of facilities. Altogether, you would say normally you will have over 20 facilities which are provided to the Italian scientific community. So it's a very good system. Of course, intramural research is supported by this, but I think that's the reason why I went to Italy, because I like this model, and I feel I can do something together with my colleagues for research in Italy. That's the idea. So let me switch really on what the topic that Jean-François asked me to talk about. And I just want to emphasize the fact that Jean-François, of course, has given an example really how motors and membranes and things like this, really all these components by self-organization, they create more and more complex structure. That you go across scale, they are more and more complex. So from the molecule to go subcellular to cellular, cells from tissue, tissues form organ, and of course an organism. And it is really a problem, I think, to be able to understand this mechanism through this scale, understanding how this self-organization gets propagated across the scale. And therefore, you have to understand really how from basic components you get together into something which are really this emergent properties. And now I think, Jean-François was emphasizing a lot the role of physics in this and the role also of mechanical force. I will tell you something about this in the course of my talk. Let me begin by the first part will be on the mechanism of membrane tethering and fusion. And this is something which Jean-François has already introduced to you in his lecture before. And I'll tell you something about really some surprising role of mechanics in this, but I'll tell you more about, and also some some data from our lab that really question some of the things that the textbook thing that Jean-François talked about before, particularly the role of snares as sufficient in membrane fusion. And the second part is to tell you something about actually how in liver cells feel pressure and they adapt to this by changing, and also going to pathological situations where you have the cells succumb to abnormal pressure. So you see, mechanics will also be important in this. So let me start then by going back to something that Jean-François was talking about. I mean, this is all these compartments in the cells, the endoplasmic reticulum, the Golgi complex, the endosome, the lysosomes, a lower compartment, but compartmentalized, of course, reactions, right? Golgi AR have to build things, and endosome and lysosome have to destroy them to make new components. So obviously you can't mix this them. That's the reason why the cells have different compartments. Now, a lot of work has been devoted in the past by many of the scientists that Jean-François was citing to understand the molecular basis of these interactions and the identity behind these compartments. Bruno here's work, for example, on some proteins of the RAF family that also provide identity. So I'll tell you something about this. And so Jean-François has described to you these proteins, which are called snares. These are transmembrane proteins. And Jim Rothman has proposed that these proteins account for the ability of one membrane to bind another membrane and to form interactions. So these are proteins which are found on one membrane and the other. And you see, they form these four helical bundles. And these are very stable structures, and they bring the membrane very, very close. And somehow, the point is that it's been proposed that this leads to membrane fusion. And then once the membrane is fused, these components are on the target membrane. They have to be broken again because they have to be sent around between the different compartments so that the fusion of more vesicles is going to come. So that's one set of components that is seems very important because the idea is every membrane has its set of snares. It's more complex than this because these snares are also promiscuous. They form interactions between different type of compartments. Therefore, in a compartment like an endosome, which receive cargo from the plasma membrane, from the Golgi complex, that recycle, that goes to degradation, a lot of these snares are all together. So in principle, this compartment here should fuse with everything else. And that's going to be there for a mess. So things are not happening. So these components are very important, therefore, for fusion, but they are not probably sufficient. I'll tell you, in fact, why. There is a second set of components. These are the RAB GTPases that also Jean-François has introduced to you. And those components are molecular switches, which I'll introduce in a moment, that are also many and in different compartments in the cell. RAB6, the protein that Bruno studied, and others, RAB5, the protein that we have my lab has studied, and others. And they, of course, give another layer of regulation. Now we'll tell you, what is this layer? Why do you need two layers of regulation? So these molecules act as GTPases, so as switches. They can exist in the GTP-bound form, and they are in the active form. And in the active form, they are communicating to membrane signals that is important for this membrane to fuse. But they can downregulate their activity. You can switch them off enzymatically with catalysts like GTPase activity protein, and they become inactive. And therefore, this molecule oscillates between active and inactive, active and inactive. And you will see how they are applied in order to create this interaction between this compartment together with the snares. So just to say that in evolution, these RAB GTPases have expanded enormously. It's probably the class of molecule in the membrane traffic that expanded the most. And RABs are, I don't remember, they are about, I think, 65 or 68 in human. There's a lot of them. And some of them are isoforms. Early endosome have a lot. So you can see many compartments can have many, many RAB GTPases. Some RAB GTPases can be specific for some cell type, but in reality, most cells express most of them. So it's a big machinery that gives a lot of specificity and a lot of regulation. I'm going to tell you more what they are doing. So now, this is the general scheme, refining what Jean-François was explaining before, how basically these vesicles find their target compartment and can fuse with their target compartment. So basically, these vesicles contain a rab, and they have snares on them. So they are, the first recognition is actually due to a rab. So the first recognition is the rab, the term is via effectors of rab proteins that are tethering molecules, very long proteins. And what they do, they recognize the first, the rab protein. Then you have some problem in going from a long distance to a short distance. I'll tell you how this is happening. And then finally, the snares are able to pair, because this distance is very big, really. The snares get very, very close to the membrane, 10, 20 nanometers. So you have to bridge something which is far away into something before these two recognize. So you see, that's why the snares in reality come in the second place. So in terms of specificity, the rab come first. And then you get fusion, as you have seen, really. So you have a problem there for targeting, and there are also lipids which are involved, because the lipids provide also specificity, because different lipids are in different compartments, they are not the same, particular phosphoinositide, they are different. Okay, so that's a very general scheme. Now, in the case of tethering molecules, I told you the tethering molecules are the first recognition. Well, also in this case, you find that every compartment in the cell has a number of molecule tethers. They can be very long coil-coil proteins, or it can be multi-protein complex. Anyway, this is machinery is very sophisticated. And therefore, you can see that a lot of the specificity of membrane fusion is due to a combination, a combinatorial use of Rab, their effector tethers, and snares. And now, of course, you have a machinery which gives you much more, a better regulation. So this is the molecule, and we'll not ask you to go through all of them because it's too much, but my lab has discovered the entire machinery that allows early endosome to fuse, starting with Rab5 and going through the effectors. And what is interesting is that this machinery requires genesis of generation of phosphatidylinositol 3-phosphate, which is a very specific lipid which is found only on the endosomal membrane. And this lipid allow a number of proteins, including these tethers, to bind the early endosome membrane. And then, of course, you have the snares. And what is also interesting is that the snares require also some regulation. And one of these molecules that regulate the snare is VPS45, a particular protein was found in yeast, but there is a mammalian homolog, that helps the snare to get together. And this is in complex with Rab5 effector, which is called rabenosine-5. So all these molecules, we know that they are important. Not only they are important, they are necessary, but also they are sufficient for membrane fusion, because we could reconstitute all these proteins. All the ones you see here was a 17 recombinant protein purified and assembled together in this artificial membrane. They could get really proteoliposomes that were very effective in fusion. And they were effective with kinetics, which are very fast, indistinguishable from the kinetics you can get if you purify endosome from cell and see whether they can fuse. So the T half of the reaction was about 2.5 minutes. So the machinery, therefore, of the entire machinery you see here is both necessary and sufficient to give you a membrane that are very efficient and fast in fusing. Interestingly, if you take snares alone, so the molecule that Rotman has described, they hardly fuse membrane. You have some level of fusion, but very, very little, close to noise. You look at the error bars here. It's not significant. Very, very difficult to see. In fact, the evidence that membrane fuse with snares is based on interaction, basically, by essentially due to lipids between the lab Bill Wickner, a question actually that assay was indeed demonstrating fusion, because there was no content mixing. So, but if you complement snare proteoliposome with cytosol, now you have a lot of fusion. And that means the cytosol complements the reaction by giving proteins that are important for fusion. Now, you can substitute cytosol with the recombinant proteins here, and you have a respectable, as you have seen, amount of fusion, arguing that the Rab effectors are complemented activity of SNARES, and they give you two orders of magnitude at least higher level of fusion than the SNARES alone. So therefore, I think this is demonstrating that the real fusion mechanism and specificity mechanism is due to Rab, their effectors, the tethers, and SNARES. So now the question is that, what are these Rab effectors doing? Why is this more effective? This will really be the topic of this first part of the talk before I go into the liver. So first of all, going back again to what was said before by Jean-François, you know what in the field of GTPases, RAS is the prototype, right, of what is small GTPases doing. And that's seen really as a signaling molecule. What it does, it provides a signal to cells that they have to proliferate, and it goes by a cascade of interaction that leads really to transcription factor activation in the nucleus. So the free energy of GTP binding and hydrolysis in this case is to propagate a signal. But you heard from Jean-François that motors like myosins or microtubule motors, they use nucleotide triphosphate, GTP or ATP in this case, in order to not create a signal, but create a force, a mechanical force, and that allows vesicles, for example, to move along microtubules, or myosin to slide and do in your muscle. And so here is the interesting thing that we have always, I mean, the field has always been considered small GTPases as signaling molecule, and the question is that, could it be that there is a role in mechanics? And that's something that Jean-François has emphasized a lot in his lecture, you know, the how mechanical forces are important in biology. In this case, could they be important also in this membrane-membrane interaction beyond motors? Now, let's go back, in fact, to the protein EA1, which is a tether for endosomes. It's an effector of Rab5. How can two endosomes find each other? In a cell, you have hundreds of them, and they are far away. So this molecule binds the early endosome membrane via its C-terminal, and it binds to this lipid I was telling you, phosphatidylinositol-3-phosphate, PI3P. It also binds Rab5 at the C-terminus. And then the other side, the N-terminus, has another binding site, the zinc finger, that binds also Rab5 from another membrane. So therefore, you bridge two membranes which are compatible to be undergoing interactions. The bridge is done by EA1, which, as you can see, is an ideal molecule to find another vesicle, but it's a very long molecule. It's over 200 nanometers long. Great to grasp another vesicle, but not so good if this membrane has to come closer, because 200 nanometer of a molecule which is largely coil-coil, which is therefore extended, is a long distance. You have to bring them close. You have to get the SNARES to bind. So what is happening there? How is this possible? It is possible because EA1 alone, indeed, is an elongated molecule. So therefore it is, and we know that it protrudes from the endosome membrane like a very long rod. You know, small endosomes are 200 nanometer in diameter, and they have a 200 nanometer molecule expansion. So therefore, in reality, what happens is the apparent density of this endosome increases in a way, because the EA1 is far away from the distance of the endosome, and therefore it can take another endosome or another vesicle. But what happens is when it binds Rab5, it bends. From extended, it collapses. It becomes therefore closer. And you see that because the persistent length of the molecule is decreased. And this persistent length in the warm light chain modeling physics is an expression of the elongation of the curvature of a molecule. So therefore, it does change curvature, and these are many molecules which have been counted in this way, showing therefore the Rab5 make the protein to become flexible. So now, of course, you know where I come from. I went in Milan, etc. I know that this is not a very popular thing in France, but it's very popular in Italy. I use this metaphor. Basically, it's like cooking pasta. The molecule is first extended, and now by cooking it, it becomes flexible. It's a little bit what happens. Now, physicists will always say, who pays for that? We have to open the gas and warm up the water. In this case, energy has to be paying. And in fact, there has to be a budget in this that is used. But of course, the idea is that GTP, the free energy or GTP binding hydrolysis is done for that. And therefore, the prediction was that changing the flexibility or the rigidity of the molecule would also create a mechanical force. And how can we study this? We can study by using optical tweezers. So we can bind the molecule. This is work which has been done together with Markus Janel and Stefan Grill. Markus was with Stefan at that time, and another biophysicist, very, very well known here. And so the idea was to have now trap beads with single molecule EA1 and RAP5 and bring them closer. And of course, then you bring them closer and apart and closer and apart. When you bring them very close, the binding of EA1 and RAP5 would occur. And now RAP5 would make EA1 to change its conformation. And in this case, collapse. And this entropy collapse that we call will create a mechanical force, which should be measurable. So the idea is that the binding will give you, indeed, this binding will give you a change in conformation, and we should measure it as a force. And that's exactly what happens. And we do measure a little force like this, 1 piconewton. So it is, of course, very small forces. And you have to imagine that this is more single molecule type of measurement. You have to imagine if there are more than one molecule, you will have a certain amount of force, mechanical force created. But what is interesting in this sense is that this is a lot of work which has been done by John Antoni, my PhD student, again with Markus and Stefan, also teaming up with Anupam Singh, who was in Sashi Tuttupalli's lab in Bangalore, another physicist. And in this case, the idea was that and this was done really by doing some measurement and also some modeling. Basically, what EA1 and RAP5 are de facto constituting a molecular motor, not the motor that goes on filaments, but the motor where you have the binding of GTP to RAP5 and the hydrolysis of GTP to RAP5. This free energy is utilized to propel a cycle of collapse of EA1 and extension so that multiple vesicles can bind, make EA1 to collapse, and then EA1 will be released and they will go back to the extended position. You have multiple rounds of vesicle tethering and collapse. Okay, so I think this is a nice example because it shows, in fact, that these RAP GTPases can also do, together with effector, some mechanical work. And it changes a little bit the perspective of how we see really these molecules doing. So now in the case of RAP5, let's go back to the model. Now we give an identity of molecules to this. As I show you, the first approach would be EA1, RAP5 binding, causing this entropic collapse. Entropic collapse helps the membrane to get closer because you create a mechanical force. But then you have to go closer, you have to get the snares. And here come into place the second effector that I told you before, which is interesting because it is a tether. It's called rabenosine 5, it's a RAP5 effector, but it's complex to a molecule, which is called VPS45, that plays a role in the assembly of snares. And therefore here you have a mechanical coupling between a RAP5 effector and the snare regulator. And therefore it's ideal to make together this molecule from tethering to fusion. So let's see if we can test this model and see how it works. And why do we have to have RAPs and snares? So this is something which was done by Federica Caradonna, my PhD student, Yanis Kalaitzidis, with the help of Jan Schumacher, who set up the method. Again, a team of physicists again. Raoul Grover, working with Stefan Dietz, and Matt Bovin, who has been working in the interdisciplinary project together with physicists at CBG, MPI CBG. So the idea of this is to create a model where you get vesicles that are in this case not in solution, but actually we exploit the system that Jean-François was talking about. We bring them down to the cover slip, binding them to motors. And we had identified before a motor that can bind to PI3P, the lipid of the endosome. So therefore, we can immobilize some of vesicles, which we can make them fluorescent. We can give them so that they can be on motors. We don't give them ATP to be able to move. We like to have them, like using them as static linkers. But this reduces dimensionality. It is easier, therefore, to image. And then we give them a green vesicle. And we give them all the goodies I was telling you, the activator of RAB5, the change activity, EA1, so you can tether long range, rabenosin, VPS45, they can tether short range and interact with the snares, and the snares. And in fact, this in vitro system is the entire reaction I showed you before, but now we do this so that the readout is microscopy. And what is the interesting thing about this in vitro reconstitution gives us versatility, because we can add components and remove components, and then we see what happens. Gives reduced dimensionality, so you can look single events, and we can look at them over time. So we have real-time resolution. We can resolve dynamics. So it's a good system with respect to the old system that we had, which was used really which was due to content mixing. In this case, we use microscopy. So let me show you some examples. So this is the full reaction, and the idea is to see this vesicle, how they land here, and to, you see, we have the green vesicle coming, boom, and then you look at the center-to-center distance between these two vesicles. I'm just showing you an example of this. So you get this vesicle coming, one is immobilized, the other one is coming, it binds. And then you see that if they fuse, now I'm going to not to do this, but if they fuse, this the distance between the two will go down below the distance that is of the two vesicles separate. So, and we measure therefore the center-to-center distance and the apparent radius. Now, important thing is that we have also to develop some theory in order to be able to analyze the data, because it's not so simple to look at these things. I'll give you some examples. So this is our basic assay, and we have an assay basically that looks at the, in this case, is the apparent radius that increases by the fact that you fuse the two vesicles and now your radius is bigger, because from two vesicles small, you got a larger one. And at a certain moment, the center-to-center distance is before it is tethered, and then it gets fused, and therefore the center-to-center distance goes down. Okay, so now let's look at what happens if we just look at tethering. Now we don't let them fuse, we let them tether. And we resolve this tethering by having this type of the green and the red. Now, again, I use this as an example. If this is the vesicle that is put on the bottom of the tube, this will come, but if you have a tether which is long, like EA1, the distance will be high. And therefore, this thing will just cover a volume around this immobilized vesicle, which is large. And that's what you see. This is the tracks that we have. It shows you that a lot of distance is covered by the binding through EA1. The next one is what happens if we allow them to tether via rabenosine 5, which is a tether, but it's shorter than EA1. Of course, in this case, what you see is that the distance is shorter. So now, instead of having them long distance, a short distance, and therefore the space where these vesicles are tethered is lower. And you can measure this. So this is the two examples, and this is the quantification interaction profile showing you that rabenosine 5, which was also not known before, is another tether. And therefore, first you tether with EA1 because you are long the distance. Then you move to rabenosine 5 because it's a shorter distance. And then the other thing is that what you know is that rabenosine 5 complex to this regulator of snares is essential for fusion. And you get the fusion at the end, the vesicle interaction profile goes down, you basically get the fusion occurring. You have the snares, the RAB5, the EA1, rabenosine 5. If you don't have rabenosine 5, fusion does not occur. What is interesting also, and now think about, you have a RAB5 effector that tethers to membrane, short distance after EA1, and you add this couple to a regulator of snares. What if you give now the regulator of snares alone? This is Rotman approach. There is no fusion, nothing. If you give them rabenosine 5, now the next one, and you place VPS45 on together with rabenosine 5 as a complex, but you don't allow them to tether, nothing happens again. So this tells you that you must have a complex between rabenosine VPS45 to couple the tethering to the priming and pairing of the snares. So it's a good example because it's a good experiment, I think, because this was hell to do this experiment biochemically, because you get the protein that they have to be expressed and they have to be happy to be, especially if you work with components which are only one component of them is not well expressed, they unfold. But you have to really have them together or have them as mutant together. So, but this is showing you that you must have a coupling, a physical coupling between tethering by RAB and fusion by snares. Otherwise, snares alone will not do anything. Now comes the question, is that why do you need these two systems? Because if you look at it now, the frequency of detachment actually depends on the concentration of this component. So the system, the reaction can be aborted. And you see that the concentration-dependent manner, the more rabenosine VPS45 you give, the lower is the probability that you have abortion of the reaction. In fact, when you look by tracking endosome in the cells, not all endosomes that tether and fuse will fuse. Sorry, not they encounter each other, will tether and fuse. Some of them will fall apart again. So therefore, they have a certain probability. And therefore, I think this is very interesting because altogether, this means the reaction has a certain rate to be able to proceed. And this is how we are seeing it with a model as well, that you have a certain constant, reaction constant with EA1 to get these two vesicles. And you have a certain probability that the reaction continues to get the second tether to occur. And then this to get the priming of the snares to occur. And this, therefore, to get them to fusion. So now, if you had, and we call this model tethering to fusion proofreading, I think this is really basically the application of the kinetic proofreading model that you have, for example, in protein translation. So basically, you have to make sure that this reaction occurs with the right components. If you don't have enough of them, if they are not positioned in the right place, if they are not forming collectives on the membrane, you have a certain probability that the reaction can fall apart. And the more, and therefore, if the transition in this case from K1, K2, K2 to 3, or K3 to 4 is low, you have a probability that the reaction falls apart. But if you have a lot of components here, if you now start to assemble, in case of the correct match between this component, these two membranes, via the RAB effectors, then you have you facilitate the progression of the fusion over abortion of the fusion. And this is why this proofreading mechanism, in a way, we can consider it like almost like kinetic race between binding and unbinding, and progression, therefore, from tethering to fusion. I think this is, I would propose, is the reason why you have these two machineries together. They give you fidelity, and they give you really a certain quality control on the system, so that if you fuse, if you have promiscuity between molecules, it will not stay enough together so you can get the reaction to going. I think it really is an application of a kinetic proofreading mechanism. That's what I would like to propose that the RABs are doing over the snares. Okay, so one final thing. I'm showing you work which is in progress, which are very excited. Because, and this, she's vegan, Lisa. And I said, if this is working, I become vegan for a year. I'm sorry, I don't want to offend a vegan, but it's hard to be vegan to me. But I'm going to do this because this works is very important. So what we do is that we now this reaction that we are looking at it, we want to look at it by structure method, so cryo-EM. And this is really, I can tell you, difficult because you have to tune the reaction with all these components, leave them out, some of them, see controls, etc., to really see what is happening. I'll give you now a first snapshot of this. So this is the kind of thing. We are looking at proteoliposome, and you have a lot of fusion. This is 30 minutes of incubation, so a lot of things have fused. Some of them are still fusing and tethering. And you start to see these components here, we know them one by one, what they are. Some of them is EA1, some of these rabenosine, the snares. We can see them now and look at them structurally. And now you see this example here of what is happening. A lot of these proteoliposomes fuse, but there is a lot of membrane occurring. There is a lot of membrane being accumulated. Surface to volume ratio changes because they fuse. And therefore, you have a lot of membranes which are almost like becoming sheets, and they start to fold. And therefore, you see some of them gives you as if they are internal membrane, but they have been produced by the fact that you got folding, and they still keep of membranes that they still keep tethering and fusing. And I'm going to show you here the example of what we are seeing here. So it's interesting here because you see there's reactions occurring. This is one membrane, and look at them. You see. This is something which is fusing the neck between these two sheets of membrane, fusing with the other one here. And basically, what you're seeing, this long filament is EA1. You start seeing the EA1 as tethered, long distance. It moves away from the side here where you have highest curvature when you start having inside rabenosine and the snares. So we begin now to differentiate spatially in time, in place, really where are these molecules going. And of course, we are collecting the data now. We are really getting a lot of cryo-EM data in the facility of Human Technopole. This is really possible because we have a lot of high throughput because of the microscope. We have the Titan Cryos is really allowing us to do this experiment. We couldn't do it in Dresden, for example. And so we are able basically to get towards a structural analysis of what is going on with these molecules on the membrane. I hope we'll tell you more next time. And this is the segmentation. You see this is EA1, the snares there. You have some coating-like of structure. It's not really coat, but a lot of high density of these components there. You have NSF. We also put alpha snap NSF. Therefore, it's very easy to see the hexagon of NSF. NSF is the ATPase, the break, the interaction of snares, and is there in the side. So it's probably breaking the snares, which are not in trans. And so membranes and some disorder structure because a lot of these molecules are in that very flexible. But we hope that in this way we'll be able to have a good understanding of the structure of a protein tethering fusion complex in the reconstituted system. Okay, now let me move to the last part. And I'm going just to tell you something about subcellular, cellular, and tissue in the case of liver. Again, mechanical work will be important. So just for those of you who don't know the liver, I think I like to think a little bit like an hydraulic system. Basically, what the liver is made by system by units which are called lobules. And the lobules allow blood that come from the gastrointestinal tract. The intestine is the only relevance I'll have to what Jean-François was telling about. But it brings lipids that are absorbed by the intestine into the liver. And it goes by the portal vein, and the blood flows through a network of capillaries, the sinusoids, and therefore they reach every hepatocyte in the system. It's actually a very beautiful system because it's very three-dimensional. Here inside is not a tree-like structure. It's a total network. All hepatocytes are connected. In return, the hepatocyte produce bile, and the bile flows from the bile duct and goes back to the gastrointestinal tract to be able to dissolve your lipid and solubilize your lipid. So these two systems are of circulation system. They are made like this because the cells have a certain type of polarity. And here is the question. If you want to make really this the polarity of this cell so that they form this narrow tube, so bicanaliculi, it goes back into the problem of how you're going to make sure that the volume that you're making a cavity is spherical or like the tube in the bicanal equilateral cylindrical. What you have to do, you have to consider, you have to avoid that all the cells around this lumen are going to basically having the lumen to expand spherically, because otherwise you're not going to form a little tubing. That's the problem. And therefore, what Laplace's law says, in order to avoid this, to get this, you have to apply, the larger the radius you have, the more cortical tension you need to apply in order to counteract really the internal pressure that you have in the lumen. And how do the hepatocyte do that? The hepatocyte do these little tubings. And they do this, look at this. These are hepatoblasts, so the fetal precursors. These are one cell, another cell, and they form a lumen in between. And you see this lumen does not expand spherically. It elongates to form a little tubing. And what do? Of course, they have a lot of acting on the side, because I told you, Laplace's law tells you you have to really increase your tension on the side. But in addition, you see these stripes. This is the lumen extending, forming here. And sometimes it's bulging where you see it. And you have these stripes of acting. What are they? If you look by electron microscopy, these are bridges between one hepatocyte and another hepatocyte. This is the elongating lumen, and you see these bridges between these cells. And this, we think, is another element in order to avoid that the lumen blows like a balloon and instead stays as a long tube. And we call them apical bulkheads. I think is the right translation if I'm not, cloison apical, because it's like the elements of both that stabilize the structure as an engineered system and make sure really that this structure doesn't fall apart. The same thing here, we think that this allows, since you have fluid pumped inside, and that would normally, without that, blow like a balloon. In this case, this helps really to the structure to get together, while, of course, the acting here all around is being also contractile and maintain this tension. Because the mechanical model that we have done, Matt Boving and my colleagues have shown that this structure here are able to withstand double the amount of pressure than you will have under the cortical membrane without this structure. So it's a strong stabilization element. Now, how can we show that they are physiologically relevant? Well, we see them forming in development when you develop the bicanal equilibri. So the hepatocyte, they divide, they polarize, and they form these tubings. And these structures, you can see them in the developing liver. But you also, unfortunately, you can see them under pathological conditions. One thing that you can do in the animal, in the mouse, what you can do in order to increase pressure in the lumen, you can do bile duct ligation. So the bile is pumped in the liver, but the bile cannot get out of the liver. So the bile accumulates in the apical lumen, the pressure increases. What do the cells do? They put up these apical bulkheads, so they defend themselves. Unfortunately, there are pathological situations in humans. There is a very bad disease that affects children from the very beginning that is called primary sclerosing cholangitis. And this disease is a disease where you can see that in the patient, we have had several patients that we have looked in the liver, you see the formation of the apical bulkheads. Therefore, the increasing pressure in this case, because the bile cannot go out, not because the bile duct is ligated, but because it's obstructed by some immunological reaction, the bile cannot go out. And now you see that in the patient, in the control, you see almost nothing. In the patient, you see very clearly this apical bulkhead. Now, when the pressure is too big, unfortunately, you can't keep these structures anymore. And now, unfortunately, the lumen blows and become a balloon. And this is what is happening in this case. These are the pathologists, they call them hepatocyte rosette. It turns out that what they are basically large extension of the bile canal equilibrium, because they cannot keep small anymore, and therefore they blow. And you see them, many hepatocytes, usually you have one hepatocyte with another hepatocyte, and they form the bile canal equilibrium. In this case, it's several hepatocytes, they look together. And therefore they form this not truly only like a balloon, but they form a larger tube. So they expand because the pressure is too high and the apical bulkheads are not sufficient to keep it like this. And therefore, they blow like this. And not only they blow, but even they change gene expression because they start to express markers of the bile duct cells. The bile duct cells are different from the hepatocyte. And yet, this hepatocyte, they are hepatocyte, but they think that they are bile duct cells because of the morphology of this lumen. So it's an interesting case that you have that the cell polarity determines the fate of the cells. And this is a different polarity of the hepatocyte because the hepatocytes are multipolar, they have multiple apical poles. They become similar to the bile duct cells, which are single pole, and they are therefore expressing markers of cells that are not the normal markers, but the express markers of the bile duct cells. Okay, so now what is happening? Now, why anyway these cells change, respond to pressure? This is the question that I'd like to address at the end. And my postdoc, Aparajita Lara, has looked at this and she has realized one thing. When you give, for example, in culture, you can do this in culture with cells, like hepatoblast or hepatocyte, you give them a bile acid, TCA. And what she has seen is that she noticed that a lot of endosome, early endosome and late endosome, are underneath the apical surface. This is the bile canal E. coli. And you see, it's a very unusual, I can tell you in epithelial cells, you will never see this. So this, a lot of these endosomal compartments are subapical. And therefore, you smell like this is going to be something important when you challenge them with high pressure. In fact, what happens, if you have really high pressure with TCA, you have some alterations of this compartment. They become large. They become, in fact, multilamellar. They become also dysfunctional. So the endosome become large. They have a lot of membrane that they cannot digest. In fact, we know that the lysosome that you have there by electron microscopy are full of membrane, multilamellar. So they have internalized fluid and membrane, and they are not able to digest those membrane because they are impaired in acidification and therefore in the gradative activity.
So this is inside the cell?
This is inside the cell. This is inside the cytoplasm. They are close to the apical surface. So you have a response by this endosome and lysosome that are becoming dysfunctional. So what is happening here? Now, what is interesting now, you can ask the question, if I change the lysosome activity, what happens to the lumen? It turns out if you impair lysosomal acidification and lysosomal activity with a number of drugs, the lumen expands as well. So it's exactly, if you act on the lysosome inside the cell, the lumen outside is expanding. There is a control between them. So it's very, very surprising because that's a new role of endosome and lysosome in responding to changes in pressure or even causing changes in lumen morphogenesis in this case. And now, what is the reason why this is happening? Well, it turns out that in the apical lumen under basal condition, it's really the bile is full of calcium. There is a lot of calcium in. Now expand the lumen by, for example, TCA, by giving this bile is osmolytes, so increases the osmotic pressure. And what happens in this case, you trigger calcium to go in via piezo, the canal piezo, which is a mechanosensitive canal, to go inside the cell. And in fact, what happens is that you can basically demonstrate that using a calcium tracer that indeed TCA causes, and also PEG, you can also give an osmolite like PEG, it increases calcium inside the lumen, inside the cytoplasm. Instead of being in the lumen, it goes inside the cytoplasm. So therefore, piezo probably is important in this mechanosensing reaction. And we know, in fact, that if we inhibit piezo, we rescue this increase in cytosolic calcium. These are the normally the in control, the calcium, this is a calcium fluorescent sensor. The calcium is the bicanal E. coli. If you treat them with TCA, you have that in cytoplasm, you see the cytoplasm. If you downregulate with a siRNA or with a pharmacological inhibitor piezo, you don't get calcium inside the cytoplasm. And therefore you see that this calcium influx into the cell is mediated by the mechanical activation of piezo, which is a mechanosensitive channel. So if this is the case, you can also rescue this. You can have the pumps on the endosome. In this case, TRPML1 is a channel that allows calcium to flow in the lumen of the lysosome. And in this case, you have, if you have an agonist that promotes the activity of these channels, so pumps calcium, you rescue this activity. In this case, you get the calcium levels in the cytoplasm get restored. And so this shows indeed that acting on the calcium is indeed the trigger to get calcium inside the cytoplasm, and therefore this effect that you have seen before. So basically what is happening, we think, is that the expansion of the lumen causes indeed calcium, piezo activation. You elevate cytosolic calcium, and then because of the abnormal level of calcium, which are not handled well by the lysosome become dysmorphic and dysfunctional. And because of that, you create a positive feedback, because the more lysosomes are not able to sustain this regulation, the more the lumen becomes become larger. And therefore, it gets really, in these patients, we see a lot of activity like this happening, not only just in the manipulation that we do in the pathoblast, on the pathocyte, we see indeed this happening also in the tissue of the patients by using a number of techniques, including electron microscopy. We see a lot of dysfunctional lysosome and endosome. And we think that this is basically a pathologic expansion of the bicanalicular lumen, which is mediated by the fact that the endolysosome system cannot accommodate all this fluid and membrane and degradation that is happening normally, and now this falls apart. And therefore, this normal feedback system that you have under normal condition, where the pressure is not enormous, the calcium level is little, and the endosome lysosome can take normal homeostasis, then everything is fine. But if you exaggerate with this, the pressure is too high, a lot of fluid is there, cells start to internalize fluid from the apical side, the endosome lysosome is dysfunctional, and now you go into a disaster for these cells. In fact, these cells really are suffering a lot, and they die. So I think we have a way of explaining now what is happening under pathological reaction, but also to understand this mechanical component of sensing of the apical side that you see under also normal pathological conditions. And this, as I told you, you can block this if you help calcium to be released by this agonist of the calcium channel that I mentioned before. And this goes back into rescuing. If you do that, you rescue the lysosome and you rescue also the lumen of the bicanaliculi. Okay, so what to tell you is that I think it's interesting that the pathocyte, they sense pressure and they respond. They respond in two ways, by accumulating the apical bulkheads. And if the elevated pressure is too big, that triggers the formation of these bile duct-like structures, which I showed you is a pathocyte rosette described by the pathologist. This is just an exaggerated lumen expansion. Now, there is a mechanosensitive response to this lumen pressure mediated by piezo, and this causes influx of canalicular calcium into the cytosol, and this leads to problems with endosome lysosome, which therefore respond. And now, impairment of lysosomal function, if you do it independently, you cause also problem with the lumen. So there is really indeed a relationship between these two. And now the agonist of the lysosomal calcium channel, TRPML1, is able even to restore the apical lumen. Indeed, suggested that this calcium flux is important as a trigger for this activity. So I close here thanking you. I'm just saying that if you're looking for a lab or to do your postdoc or your PhD, we are hiring a lot. We are expanding. We are enjoying an area of expansion, a time of expansion, so we can give a lot of positions at various levels, PhD, postdoc, group leader. And I just want to thank the people that did the work. I mentioned them all. the team of physicists that you guys know very well, and then the people that I mentioned in my talk. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.